One of his first suppliants after his return from Egypt was Desiree. She begged him to be godfather to her infant son, a son, the gift so coveted by Bonaparte already, so doubly to be coveted in the future. Desiree, not averse to this form of revenge upon her hated rival, the old woman, as she called Josephine, paraded her maternity to the utmost, and Napoleon, hiding his chagrin under a gracious bearing, accepted the sponsorship and chose the name of Oscar from the days of his favorite Ossian. A trifling gift this, but he held richer ones in reserve for his godson. Bernadotte may thank his marriage for his marshal's baton, his principality of Pontecorvo, and his crown, said Napoleon. His treacheries under the empire were overlooked on the same grounds. The record of these treacheries is no trifling one. Bernadotte proclaimed his opposition at the outset on Brumaire 18, notwithstanding which he was summoned to take part in the Council of State of the following day and appointed to the command of the Army of the West. Holding this post, he not only opposed but conspired against the First Consul and even attempted to raise an insurrection against him. The details have become history. For this offense, he received no punishment whatsoever. Bonaparte contented himself with endeavoring to get rid of him by appointing him ambassador to the United States. Bernadotte characteristically agreed to go, but by a series of adroit maneuvers contrived to postpone indefinitely the equipment of the frigates that were to convey him. A year later, he was implicated in Moreau's conspiracy and escaped because Bonaparte spared him once more for Eugenie's sake. He did a good deal more than spare him. In fact, for having bought all Moreau's possessions, his estate at Grosbois and his house in the Rue d'Anjou, he presented the latter for which he had paid 400,000 francs to Bernadotte. Then came the days of the empire when Eugenie's husband was made a marshal of the empire, commander of the 8th cohort of the Legion of Honor, president of the Electoral College of Vaucluse, and knight of the Black Eagle. On Eugenie herself, he bestowed a revenue of 300,000 francs, a sum of 200,000 francs in ready money, and the sovereignty of the Principality of Pontecorvo. For her sake, he forgave our Stadtwagram and Valkyrin and overlooked two military blunders undoubtedly deserving of a harsher name, following on an intrigue with the royalists in which Bernadotte, Fouché, and Talleyrand essayed the methods that resulted finally in the return of Louis the Desired in 1814. Meantime, he was unwearying in attentions and kindness to Desiree, which might seem excessive, but for his evident anxiety to make reparation when Bernadotte was wounded at Spandau. Napoleon wrote to him 2 days afterwards, rejoicing that Madame Bernadotte was able to be with him, and adding, "Give Madame la Marechale 1,000 kind messages from me, together with one little reproach. She might have written me a few lines telling me the Paris news, but I will defer my quarrel with her on this score until we meet." There was no end to the marks of favor by which he distinguished her. One of the three magnificent fur pelisses presented to him by the Emperor of Russia after Erfurt was put aside for Desiree. Costly gifts, Sevres vases, Gobelin tapestries, were sent to her on all occasions, though she seldom appeared at court and made no secret of her hatred for Josephine and the Beauharnais. Was it not of Desiree Napoleon was thinking when, after Walcheren, he proposed the appointment of Bernadotte as Governor General of Rome and consequently as Grand Dignitary of the Empire to hold a viceregal court at the Quirinal with a civil list of 3 millions, a position equal in splendor to that of Borghese in Turin and Elise in Florence, and little inferior to that of Eugene at Milan when Bernadotte was elected hereditary Prince of Sweden after the rejection of the title by Eugene, who declined to apostatize. The result was largely due to the benevolent neutrality of Napoleon. The emperor's policy on this occasion has seemed to some obscure and unintelligible. They failed to read his heart. He was dazzled by the prospect of seeing a woman in whom he took an interest, a queen, and his god godson, a royal prince. He himself arranged all the details of Desiree's presentation in court when she came to take leave as Princess of Sweden. He invited her to the family dinner on Sunday, an unprecedented honor. To Bernadette, he made a grant of 1,000,000 francs from the public service fund. He further compounded handsomely with him for the various benefactions he had himself made him, notably the Principality of Pontecorvo, and crowned his bounty with a pension and a title to Bernadette's brother. He had indeed proved his right to say in a subsequent letter to Eugenie, "I am sure you have long been convinced of my strong attachment to your family." 4 months later, Bernadette leagued himself with Russia against Napoleon, and in less than a year, a rupture between France and Sweden was imminent. Desiree had only consented under strong pressure to a short sojourn at Stockholm. "I thought," she said, "that Sweden, like Pontecorvo, is merely a place from which we were to take our title." At the first signs of the approaching storm, she hastened back to her house in the Rue d'Anjou. Napoleon very cautiously approached the Minister for Foreign Affairs at this juncture, desiring him to hint to the Swedish minister his great regret that the Princess of Sweden should have returned to Paris without permission, and the desirability of showing her that her conduct was contrary to etiquette and her absence from her husband at such a crisis most unseemly. Desiree chose to ignore the message and made all preparations for remaining. In November, on the eve of the declaration of war, the Emperor wrote again. He sent word by Cabeceres to the Queen of Spain, Desiree's sister, that he wished the princess to leave at once and return to Sweden, that her presence in Paris at such a time was scandalous. Desiree, however, had made up her mind to stay. She went on ordering dresses from Leroy, receiving her friends and giving entertainments. She went to drink the waters with her sister, came back to Etoy, and finally returned to Paris as if nothing had happened. She even thought it very extraordinary that her French friends should blame the former Marshal of the Empire, who had now become Generalissimo of the combined forces of Northern Germany. If we are to accept the testimony of several well-informed persons, we must believe that while conveying Napoleon's final adjurations to Bernadette, she also acted on various occasions as intermediary between her husband Fouché and Talleyrand. If it could be clearly proved that Desiree took advantage of the Emperor's weakness for her to be the willing tool of conspirators who knew each other of old, what should we be forced to think of her? Let us give her the benefit of the doubt and believe that her motives in remaining were her passion for Paris and her reluctance to give up her sister, her nieces, her favorite society and habits. She was still in Paris in 1814 and took part in the reception of the Russian Emperor. She was there too in 1815 during the Hundred Days, and on June 17th, the eve of Waterloo, she ordered from Leroy a Nankin riding habit and a cambric dressing gown trimmed with Valenciennes. It was Eugenie who now was forgetful. Chapter 3. Josephine de Beauharnais. Towards the close of Vendemiaire, year 4, October 1795, chance brought about a meeting between the Vicomtesse de Beauharnais and General Bonaparte. The latter had suddenly become famous, the name which was almost unknown, but a day before, the name with which Barras was so unfamiliar that he wrote it Bonaparte, had echoed through France with the thunder peals of the cannon that scattered the rebel sections of the convention, appointed second in command of the Army of the Interior, and afterwards general-in-chief. One of Bonaparte's first measures was the disarmament of the Parisians. A youth presented himself at headquarters and begged for permission to keep his father's sword. Bonaparte saw the lad himself, took a fancy to him, and granted his request, whereupon he received a visit of thanks from the boy's mother, a lady, a great lady, a ci-devant Vicomtesse, the widow of a president of the Constituent Assembly, a courtier, a general in command of the Army of the Rhine, all of which the title and rank, the refinement, the easy and aristocratic grace of his visitor made a great impression upon Bonaparte. For the first time, the provincial of 26, hitherto unnoticed by any woman of this class, found himself face to face with one of those elegant, seductive, delicate beings whom he had hitherto admired from afar. And the part of protector he was called upon to play for the first time flattered his pride and was eminently to his taste. Josephine, who was in extremities, at once saw with what manner of man she had to deal. a Creole from Martinique, married at the age of 16 to the Vicomte de Beauharnais by an adroit aunt who lived openly with the Vicomte's father, the Marquis de Beauharnais. Josephine Tascher de la Pagerie had led a stormy life since her arrival in Paris in 1779. Her husband, after deceiving and deserting her, had separated from her through no fault of hers. She had no social amusements to console her, for her aunt's equivocal position had barred the entrance both to court and to society. After her separation from her husband, she had more liberty and took advantage of it. Said scandal, she traveled and spent a considerable time in Martinique. After the revolution, she was reconciled to her husband, who became successively deputy of the States General, president of the Constituent Assembly, and commander-in-chief of the Army of the Rhine. For a brief space, she lived happily and had a salon, finding herself for the first time in the world and profiting by the experience. Then came the terror. Beauharnais was imprisoned, guillotined. She herself, also a prisoner, escaping death by a miracle. When she was released from the prison, Descartes, Thermidor 9, she was past 30. She had two children and was completely ruined. By the help of certain feminine friends she had made, chiefly in prison, for few others were left her, she again entered society, borrowing right and left, running into debt, and eking out these resources by occasional supplies from the West Indies. She managed to keep up appearances. She left her lodging in the Rue de l'Université and took a small house, number 6, in the Rue Chantereine, which she rented from Louise Julie Carreau, Madame Talma, for 4,000 livres or 10,000 livres in assignats. There she installed herself on Vendemiaire 10, year 3, October 17, 1794.